The recent economic downturn brought with it soaring debt levels, staggering foreclosure rates, and widespread job losses. But even as the economic indicators seem to be improving, what the statistics don't mention are the struggles of individual families. Joining us now to talk about that is the author of a new book called Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times. She is also a sociologist at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. Dr. Mary Ann Cooper, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you here. Good to have you here. As we chatted a little bit before the show, I went through your book and I mean in some of the notes, and it was, I mean, I just got very depressed at the picture that was painted.
Yeah, it's a very sad story. What's happened over the last 40 years as Americans have really struggled to adapt to a rise in insecurity.
And I've seen that with family and friends as well, that, you know, people that I know and you know, have been through a few periods of underemployment myself, and you really come to the realization that, you know, that, hey, this is a different time.
Yeah, it is a different time, and the statistics bear that out. I'm sure all the listeners have heard the statistics about growing income inequality and rising economic insecurity. And I think the problem with the statistics is that they can be a rather sterile way of explaining what's happening. And so my goal with the book was to go out and talk with people from rich to poor, from well-paid business executives to low-paid domestic workers, and find out how they're coping with these large-scale transformations, these really powerful forces.
In putting a human face on it, you talk a good deal in the book about how the so-called safety nets that families have relied on for so many years are either gone or have diminished. What do you mean by that, and what examples are you talking about?
Sure. So what sociologists and political scientists and economists have really done a lot of research on is what we call the changing social contract between employers and employees. And after World War II, there was a relationship that between employers and employees that rested on mutual protections and mutual loyalties. And what that meant was that companies paid good wages, provided good benefits, and in return, workers were very loyal to their employers and used all of their skills and abilities to help build that company. And so it was a two-way mutual aid sort of relationship. And then a lot of things began to happen, political changes, social changes, and that whole relationship became undone. The globalization increased to competition, and businesses had to adapt, which is one reality. So companies needed to kind of change their workforce or move workers around or go to contingent labor forces. But there was also a moral or an ethical change, which is that companies started no longer to feel like they owed their workers anything. And workers in return felt the same way. And we've heard phrases like free agent nation. But in that context, everyone's really on their own. All the benefits that you used to get through your job, that even how we would describe, you know, lower skilled workers or less educated workers, all the things that enable people to have a good, secure life, like health benefits and good pay, began to erode.
I mean, what does it say about our society that we've kind of evolved into, you know, I got mine, you know, and the heck with you?
It's certainly a big departure from the way we felt after the Great Depression. And that was another huge, you know, economic difficulty that so many Americans were struggling with, that there became, again, a conversation about values. And that conversation was, we are much better when we all stand together. We are much better off if we provide security to each other in both good times and bad. And that way of seeing the world and that set of values actually led to a whole host of policies, from, you know, social security to strengthening the safety net, and also a way of treating one another, an expectation that companies weren't just looking out for the bottom line, that they also looked out for their workers, their employees. And then over time, that began to erode. And we saw that in policies, and for example, the number of companies that stopped offering health care or pensions to their employees. But we also saw it in values. So it is a huge departure from where we were post-Great Depression.
It's interesting, though, that, I'm the child of parents who went through the Great Depression, mm-hmm. classic baby boomer, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I can recall talking to my parents and even my grandparents who all went through it, and they were saying that, yeah, it was incredibly tough, but we all looked out for each other, mm-hmm. Whether you were family or a neighbor or a friend. Mm-hmm. Do you see any sense that that's even happening to any degree in today's context?
I think families will always look out for each other, and most of us rely on our family and friends to make it through hard times. But I think times have gotten so hard that people are so focused on just surviving that understanding and speaking out against this change in our values has become another thing to do that most of us just can't get to. The focus is on getting food on the table, finding that next job, dealing with that pay cut that's coming. And that takes a lot of focus and energy to just cope with that. And so I think that's really separated us from seeing things from a bigger perspective and understanding that what's happening to us isn't just our own individual personal problem. It's actually a failure of policy.
Getting into your book specifically, you profile many individual families in the book, highlighting their specific struggles. Mm-hmm. Why was it important for you to provide that perspective to the conversation? And who really stands out in your mind as having a particularly compelling story?
Well, my point in interviewing people from rich to poor was that if we want to understand how our society is pulling apart, we've got to talk to everybody. Most sociological examinations of these issues focus on the people who have lost the most, so the poor and the working class and the middle class. I wanted to talk to everyone to really understand what's happening. And what that enabled me to see is that we're not just pulling apart economically, we're also pulling apart emotionally. So one of the most interesting things or unexpected things that I found was that many times the anxiety among affluent families was just as palpable as the anxiety among middle and working class families. Of course, their issues were less pressing. They didn't have, they weren't worried about maybe making their mortgage payment. But in this context of extreme insecurity, everyone is worried. And so one of the most surprising things is that we're actually all weighed down by something very similar, which is the anxiety generated by hard times.
I mean, it's easy to imagine somebody, in a lower income strata or even a middle income strata, hearing that and saying, that a person who is in a wealthy category has worries, and I mean, I could hear my dad saying, well, yeah, I bet you life's tough at that end of the income scale. But I mean that's almost a little I guess unfeeling. So how do you connect with or reconnect some feeling that, hey, we're in a sense we're all in this together regardless of what we make for a living?
Sure. Well, certainly, I'm not arguing that we should feel sorry for rich people who feel like they need to have millions more dollars in order to feel secure. I mean, that's certainly not what I'm saying. But I think we need to understand how we are all coping and adapting to such high levels of inequality and insecurity. I mean, really, the levels are almost unprecedented. And for a society to have such instability and such division, the question really is, why isn't there more unrest, and why aren't people taking to the streets? In a lot of other societies, that's what has happened. But what I learned from looking at how all different socioeconomic groups are coping with this is why that isn't happening. Because what I found is that in this crazy context, the rich think they don't have enough and are striving for more, and the middle class and working class families feel like there's nothing they can do to change their situation, so they lower their expectations and try to get themselves to accept less and less. Understanding these dynamics enable us to understand why we're putting up with the current state of affairs.
I mean, it sounds like the American dream has taken a major hit.
Yes, the American dream has taken a very big hit, for sure. The American dream has long been equated with owning a home or moving up the class ladder. But achieving those kinds of goals, people have to believe that they're even attainable. And what I found is that people are letting go of their dreams because something outside of their control, like a layoff or an uninsured medical emergency, comes along and just blows it for them. So they've learned that it's really almost too painful to have dreams. And the problem with this is that there is a psychological underpinning to the American dream, right? The belief that if you work hard, you will have security and prosperity. And that's beginning to change. Recent surveys on the American dream are showing that American families are less focused on moving up and more focused on holding on to what we have. So the desire to own a home is being replaced by the desire to be debt-free and to have financial stability. And so what that means is that in insecure times, there's a huge personal and societal cost, which becomes the inability to dream, the inability to think that things can actually get better.
I wonder if I could turn this around a little bit and say, is there a positive out of all of this that maybe, Americans are learning that, you know, the things that we always thought we had to have may not be that all that necessary, and we can still lead a good life?
Well, I think the positive thing that I'm starting to see is that there is a drumbeat about growing inequality and growing insecurity. And it's really popped up in the last 5 years as a result of the Great Recession. People are starting to, I think, get to a point where they're saying, this isn't okay anymore. This is not the mark of a prosperous society where only certain people can get ahead and everyone else just falls behind. So I'm heartened by the focus on these issues. And then the question is, how are we going to get out of it, or what can we do to alter it? And there it gets into the nitty-gritty of policymaking. But there's really a larger national conversation that's occurring, and it's a very fierce one, which is the role of government in providing security to people. And there's different views on this, and there's many, many conversations. The fight over the Affordable Care Act really hinged on this central question. But when you look historically, there's only been one time in our country where we've had a thriving middle class. And there were a lot of policies and a lot of different ways of doing business that existed at that time that led to that creation of a middle class. So my hope is that in this whole conversation that we're having about inequality, we might look back on that time and try to change things so it looks more like that, when families were better set up for success.
Got a caller on the line, John from Marysville. What is your comment or question for Dr. Cooper?
Well, just a real quick question, and I don't think I've bought a book in years, but this is one book I'm going to buy. And I wanted to ask the author how it compares to a book that came out about 10, 11 years ago called Bowling Alone. Is it a companion piece? Is it completely different, or does it take a larger macro look at society? And the only other thing I want to say quickly and controversially, controversy surrounds this remark, but it seems to me, from my impression, that religion itself is impeding any hope of community, in the sense that, and I know that sounds contradictory, but whenever somebody benefits from a government program, they thank God, rather than really understanding that it takes communal action to get them the benefits that they need. Does the author know where I'm going with that?
Yeah, I think I can speak to your question. First, with the bowling alone, it is this idea that we are in many ways isolated. I do build on that idea that we're so focused on coping and surviving with what's in front of us that we're not really reaching out as much as we could, at least in regard to saying that we're actually all in this together. So we might be isolated in our worry, but we're all worrying. It's all something that we share. I did In talking with a lot of families, what I learned is that for poor and working class families, religion, the belief that God provides, the belief that God has a plan for them, is central to how they cope with the hard times that they experience. And many of them relied on their churches to not only provide the kind of basic needs of food, clothing, shelter, but also to provide the spiritual support that they needed to cope with the difficulties that they experienced. So, and I hear that what the caller is saying in the sense that anytime something good happened to one of these families, they really believed that it was a blessing from God. I never heard a rich person say to me, my 401k went up 20% last year, God's really blessing me. That it wasn't a way that they, even among religious, well-off people who were religious, they just didn't have that sort of understanding of the way God was working in their life. And if you think about the way welfare has changed, increasingly we are outsourcing welfare from the federal government down to the states and also to faith-based organizations. And while many faith-based organizations do a tremendous job providing for the needy, and churches are doing a huge amount for families that are struggling financially, I do write it about in the book that this can create the context for coercion, because when religious institutions are defining who's in need, that can come with all kinds of prerequisites, like having to believe in God or saying that you have a particular faith or something like that. So it's an interesting aspect of the story to understand, because we need religious institutions to help the needy, but that shouldn't be the only place where needy families can turn.
Dr. Marianne Cooper, author of the book Cut Adrift, Families in an Insecure Times, and Dr. Cooper's going to stay with us. We're going to take a little break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, filling in for Ann this week. This hour, we're talking about the economic and emotional struggles that American families are facing in this time of job losses, soaring debt, and income stagnation. The process of staying afloat can be difficult for many families, and getting ahead can even be harder. Still with us on the phone is Dr. Marianne Cooper. She's the author of a new book called Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times. The cover is stunning, because it literally is a family in a rowboat with a rope. I don't know if you can see it, with a rope that's frayed to the last thread. It's a very powerful statement just in the cover, much less getting into the book itself. Dr. Cooper, thanks again for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
You had mentioned earlier that there's really only been one time in our nation's history previous where we've seen, the degree of prosperity that, people felt comfortable, people felt, felt a sense of worth and a sense of, maybe a sense of community or a stronger sense of community. How do we learn from that past era? What lessons do we take from that and try to apply today?
Well, I think the lesson that we take away is that we need to set each other up for success. And the way that we do that is by giving people policies and paths that enable them to translate working hard into moving up. It is the basic premise of the American dream. And for the generation post-World War II up until about the 1970s, That was really true. I mean, of course, it wasn't perfect, and women and people of color were often excluded. But for millions of Americans, that was true, and it created a huge middle class, and a lot of people went to college because it was affordable, and the economy grew, and we all prospered. And so, the interesting thing is that really sits on our collective psyche about how we think of America, that we have families that if they work hard, they succeed. But since the 1970s, that that whole thing has become undone. And the Great Recession really was the intensification of a lot of trends of rising debt and unemployment. And when people lose jobs, they find new ones, but they pay less. But if we have it in our collective psyche still, I think that's helpful because it gives us a goal to work towards, that something that we believe is the right way that our society should be set up. And then that gives us a way of coming together to talk about what we need to do to get back to that.
We're of course living in a time in an economy, as you just alluded to earlier, where women are much more heavily involved in the workplace than back in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. How is this stress that you talk about manifesting itself among women who are, in many cases now, in greater cases than ever before, the major breadwinner for their families?
Yeah, this was a story I saw again and again. In the majority of American families, women are the primary breadwinner or the co-breadwinner. And so families are really reliant on women to put the food on the table. And as women have stepped increasingly into this role of provider, we're seeing a change in households, which is what I called it in my book, is that women have become the designated warrior in many middle class and working class families. So they're the ones that see what expenses are coming up, like the property taxes or the school field trips or the rent, and they do the calculations in their head. And they feel that worry. They feel that twinge of dread in their stomach. They see the money coming into the bank account. They see it going out of the bank account. And they're really the ones that are losing sleep at night. And I talked to many women who talked about how they were trying to share this burden with their husbands, but their husbands weren't stepping up to the plate. And what I ended up realizing is that in many cases, women now are out-earning their husbands or are more educated than their husbands. And so in these families, we're seeing several trends coming together, which is middle-class and working-class families facing more insecurity and women in those families being the ones best positioned to handle it.
And not just married women, we should also indicate too, but a lot of single parent households, men and women.
Yes. I mean, the number of single parents is growing, and about 84% of those, I think, are headed by women. So it's women are increasingly the ones carrying the burden for their families. And in the book, I write about how there is now, in addition to the second shift in family life where you go to work during the day and then you come home and getting dinner on the table and doing the laundry, increasingly we have what I call the insecurity shift. When families are constantly, every year or even every few months, facing these unsettling, destabilizing events, someone in the family has to be on call to fix it. And there are practical ways of fixing it, right? Like you maybe take out another credit card or you try to figure out who you can borrow money from. But there is a whole emotional way that we're having to cope with this. It's the women who are doing this. They're the ones who are, calculating things. And I had a woman was telling me that she keeps everything on an Excel spreadsheet and she's crunching the numbers and she's just alone in that burden. And it takes a huge physical and psychological toll. Many women told me that they were losing sleep at night, that they, one mother said to me, I probably drink more than I should. And it causes a lot of conflict in the relationships because there's this unequal division of burden in these families between the wives and the husbands.
And it almost sounds like a lot of that, that third shift almost that you talk about, that insecurity shift, oddly enough, probably takes place in that last hour or so before somebody goes to bed.
Yeah, I mean, one family I came to know very well, the mother, Gina Califato, the first time I interviewed her, and she was talking to me about how she worries a lot. And I said, and how this leads her to have insomnia. And I said, when was the last time that you had insomnia? And she said, I've been up since 3 a.m. And I think I was interviewing her at like 10 a.m. Yeah, it's the toll that this takes is, I think people feel very alone. I think a lot of women feel like, they're not only are they having to earn the money to, you know, buy the food, but then they're literally cooking it at home too. And it's almost just too much responsibility. And I think as people are trying to adapt to these changes, they keep thinking about what can I personally do better? Can't I just manage my money better? Can't I just, you know, figure out how to fix it myself? And what I'm trying to say in the book is this is not people's personal failings, and this is not incumbent on individuals to fix. This is a much larger problem in our society.
So we need to really start seriously looking at some policy fixes.
I think people are literally talking themselves through insecurity. They're literally trying to push down their anxiety, try to pretend that things are better. I mean, be optimistic in the face of what is actually complete insecurity and poverty. And we're actually asking people to do that. And I just feel like it would be better if we could all worry a little less and dream a little more. I think that's the way that we should be pushing in policy and in a national conversation, again, about what values we're going to hold dear.
We had an email from one of our listeners, Avery, and she said, "This country's always been very individualistic ever since its foundation. I personally don't like how individualistic we are and wish that we would be more communal. What could we do in order to become more communal? And is that part of the answer?"
I think so. I think that the sentiment is exactly correct. We believe in individuals in this country, and there's a beauty to that because we believe in individual rights, and that gives us freedoms that so many people around the world wish to have. The downside to believing that the individual is supreme is that it can lead to us not looking out for one another. It makes everything, the individualism is the filter through which we all see what's happening to us. And that's what gets us into these interpretations of when someone has an uninsured medical emergency, them sort of blaming themselves for this happening, right? Instead of saying, no, we should have a different system where if someone gets hurt in a car accident, that shouldn't mean for the rest of their life they're struggling under the weight of economic debt. And that doesn't just affect them. It also affects their ability to set their children up for their children's futures. So I think what I would encourage people to do is just to start thinking about these issues that happen to them less as something that's just happening to them personally, and to think about the fact this is happening to everybody. And what can we do to help us all?
This is also, you know, and clearly, you know, no big revelation. This is also an election year. We've got midterm elections coming up. We've got statewide elections coming up. What can people be saying to both their incumbent elected representatives, but also the people that are challenging them for office? What kind of noise should the general public, the voting public, be making?
Well, I think it's about policies that, again, set families up for doing better. So that's minimum wage. That is affordable health care for everyone. The Affordable Care Act has done a lot, but it's going to still leave 30 million Americans uninsured. It's about affordable college education. And it's really a belief that we all invest in each other. And so, for example, government used to give out lots of grants for people to go to college, just money to go to college. Now what the government gives out is loans, which is great. It's better than not having that. But we know that college debt is a big burden for people.
I've got a daughter who's in exactly that situation.
Yeah, so there's really been a change in what we would say of the sharing of risk. It used to be that government and corporations shared risk with individuals and their families. So we used to have pensions. Now we have 401ks. It used to be that employers shared that risk in managing our retirement money. Now we're on the hook for saving it and then for managing that money. And for whatever miscalculations or, you know, problems in the market occur. The specific policy issues are about giving people a steady footing so that they can actually have long-term goals and plans. So again, that's from just basic healthcare security to food security to good jobs with good pay so that people have a steady world. There's a lot of talk lately about, you know, people just need to have a life plan. in which they figure out how to get out of poverty. The problem is when you're in an environment where your circumstances are constantly shifting, where day to day you don't know what the next shoe that's going to drop, then you can't plan. It becomes almost impossible. And that's where I think we get people trying to cope with it by saying, you know what, I'm just going to worry about today and not tomorrow because that's the best I can do. And it is the best they can do. It's just for our society, that's not something that's going to lead to a lot of prosperity.
Are you seeing any signs in the current policy, in the current economy, that things might be turning around? I mean, are you seeing signs of hope, if you will?
Well, it does seem like the economy is turning a corner to a certain degree, so that's always positive. I think there is a larger conversation that's starting to occur about the minimum wage, about middle class families and what we need to do to support them. What I would encourage the listeners about is that we not, because we are so busy all focused on coping and surviving, that we kind of disengage from the conversation. I think there is a lot of feeling that, and it's understandable, the partisanship, it's like nothing's happening in Washington. You just kind of disengage to some degree because it's just, what can I do? I'm a single individual person. But I think that's also part of what's gotten us here, is that we haven't held people accountable. We haven't been able to muster the energy to look beyond our personal problems and say, actually, this is something that's affecting all of us and we need to do something about it. So I encourage people to the degree that they can, change that perspective.
Yeah, there seems, and I find myself saying this phrase often: "This too shall pass," and hope for the best tomorrow. But it's also getting to the point, and I sense it's in a lot of people that I know maybe we need to stand up and say something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting you talk about some of the things, some of the policy changes that you think need to be made, but we're also living in an era where we're seeing a lot of very strong political forces saying, we need less government, we need smaller government. How do you push an agenda like this through in that kind of an atmosphere?
Well, it certainly is hard, and people can have a variety of perspectives on this. But the one good thing is that everyone's talking about inequality. Republicans, Democrats, Independents, everyone's talking about it. And I think that's where it starts, is agreeing that there's a problem. I actually think one of the things is that we haven't been agreeing that it's the problem. Now I think we're starting to agree, and that starts things off. Again, I just think the data is important. I think it's important to understand when families have done better and when they've done worse, and what policies were around that led to those different outcomes. And we know, again, that, and I think that part of the conversation about inequality is that people are starting to realize is that actually, for the most part, capitalism tends towards inequality. And the times where we've had less inequality, we've had a certain set of policies and a certain set of beliefs that have tried to rein in the crueler market effects. And so since we know that data, we have all the data historically, that gives us really big clues about how things should be set up.
Dr. Marion Cooper, author of the book Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times. Dr. Cooper, we're going to take a break here, but I want to go ahead and say thank you for joining us today. Admittedly, at first I was depressed, but oddly enough, at the end of our conversation, I am feeling some hope that we, as you say, we've got the conversation going and everybody agrees there's a problem. So thank you very much for joining us. This
thank
is
you.
All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, and we are on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson. I'm filling in for Ann this week. With more and more cuts in public assistance in the state, Ohio families are struggling to dig themselves out of poverty. That's according to a new study released last week by Policy Matters Ohio, a nonprofit state policy research institute. But there may be more at play in the discussion of poverty in the Buckeye State. Joining us now to talk about the report findings is the author of the report and project director at Policy Matters Ohio, Wendy Patton. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Good to have you here. And also with us is the executive director of the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy, a nonprofit conservative-leaning research organization, Ray Perlman.
Thank you for having me, Stu.
Good to have you here, Ray. Good to have you here. We had, and I'm not sure how much you were able to get a, you know, hear the conversation that we had previously with Dr. Marion Cooper, and you know, talking about her book "Cut Adrift: Families in Insecure Times." But she seemed to be saying that we literally have a huge portion of our population. And not just people living below the poverty line, but people in the middle income level that are really, really, really struggling. In the report by Policy Matters, how would you best summarize the message of what Policy Matters is trying to get across here?
We took a look at the budget bill, House Bill 483, this spring. And we saw five different initiatives focused on the issue of public assistance. Now, we think that any focus on helping struggling families is a good thing, but we worried about these because they seem to imply that people who are enrolled in public assistance programs aren't working. That's not true. Even our cash assistance and our food stamp programs have work requirements. Hundreds of thousands of working families rely on public assistance to make ends meet. The bigger problem that we see is our economy has too few jobs and the jobs are paid too little for people to make ends meet. So that's, in the long run, what we need to be looking for is long-term solutions for all families.
It's kind of the difference between jobs to get by and jobs where you can prosper.
Yes, we have many, many jobs where people are struggling to get by. As a matter of fact, in the Columbus area, 9 out of 10 of our largest occupational groups, and this is retail sales, cashier, food prep, the most numerous jobs, pay so little that people are eligible for public assistance. And the problem is not enough people are obtaining the help that they need. So in the short run, the problem is not reducing public assistance, as many of these initiatives indicate. It's broadening the spread of that safety net and restoring it. It's been badly slashed in the last 3.5 years so that people can start to get traction and figuring out a way that families can actually move up on the career ladder. And that's primarily a long-term strategy of skill building and employment and training strategies.
Ray, I see you nodding your head quite a bit. What are you seeing from the standpoint of the Buckeye Institute?
Sure. I think, Wendy really hit on what the problem Ohio's facing, like most of the rest of the nation, that what we're seeing is an economy that is very sluggish. The recovery, particularly in the labor market, has been almost unprecedented in how weak it is. We are 4 or 5 years now since the recession has ended, and only in the last 6 to 9 months we've really seen the labor market starting to bounce back. So we need to take a look at public policies that can return workers back to work, people who want to work. I mean, we know that the unemployment rate in Ohio has dropped dramatically, but unfortunately part of that is because people who have left the labor force haven't come back in. So we need to figure out what type of public policies we can do to encourage the economic growth that this country has been used to put people back to work, and then wages will increase as the economy increases.
But yet we also have the current state administration saying that, that Ohio has created, I think the figure we had recently was 244,000 new jobs. The drum beating is already going on. But what's the reality of those 244,000 new jobs?
Jobs are difficult to get and keep in this economy. We're still more than $100,000 below the number of jobs we had in the most recent recession, and more than 330,000 jobs below the number of jobs we had in the recession of the early 2000s. We have not recovered the number of jobs here in Ohio. And some of this is long-term policies. The state could engage in policies to create more and better jobs. For example, one very concrete lever that the state has is public jobs. While the nation has restored public jobs lost since the last recession, Ohio has actually lost public jobs. We've lost 6.4% of our public jobs since the recession started. Now, that's a lever that we could actually move. But instead of rebooting and reboosting our public jobs, we've eliminated 6 out of every 100 public jobs that we have a direct lever on. There are ways that the public sector can create jobs and can boost income, and we need to think more about these long-term strategies.
But we know economic growth really comes from the private sector, and the story of Ohio's economic decline has been the falling competitiveness of its private sector, and this is an ongoing, decades-long problem. So our solution should be saying, what can we do to bring manufacturers out, to have Ohio compete, not just with Texas, not just with other states like Michigan, but now what can we do to make Ohio competitive around the world? Unfortunately, you know, the idea that we can sit there and simply spend our way out and spend Ohio back to competitive economy, that doesn't really seem to be a viable solution, given the fact that we've been going down this road for such a long time and we are falling farther and farther behind the rest of the nation. Ohio is lagging the nation in every category in terms of job creation. So we need to figure out, what policies do we have in Ohio? Why is our tax code so confusing that businesses don't want to be created? Why is entrepreneurship, which we know is really the engine to job growth, why is that not happening in the state? And what can we do to make regulations, taxes easier to encourage local businesses to start?
So let's take that aspect of the private sector and policies that encourage. And yet we have a legislature that passed a two-year freeze on energy standards that directly affected things like solar power industries and wind energy industries. And I know Amy Hanauer from Policy Matters recently was quoted up in Cleveland as saying Ohio might as well have put a sign up saying, if you're in the wind energy or solar energy business, you know, you might as well not bring your business to Ohio and create jobs. So how does that, you know, how do we get everybody in sync here and say, you know, hey, this is, you know, we need, if we're going to have policies to create jobs, let's be consistent about it.
Well, Stu, I think, you know, any type of industry can do very, very well if the government's going to throw them a massive amounts of money. But, you know, let's look, that money has got to be coming from a business that's already existing, that's successful. And so my problem, you know, with the idea of saying, you know, why the green energy freeze might halt jobs is because you got to think about where that money is coming from. It's coming from your industries that are productive. And so it's going to be the small businessman, this computer designer who said, I'm not going to be able to expand because now my taxes have to go to pay for an industry that cannot make it in the marketplace by our own. And so we want to make sure that we are encouraging fair competition and not having government coming in putting their thumb on the scales, because, you know, we've seen industrial policy like this in the United States, we've seen it in Europe, and it does not create the sustained economic growth, because what happens is you're hurting your productive industries. And so Ohio has always been a leader in the energy sector, and so we want to make sure that we're not trying to penalize our effective energy, looking at, you know, oil mining and natural gas, trying to create ideas that simply aren't viable right now in the marketplace.
Wendy, in the context of the report that you authored, how do you respond to that?
I think boosting manufacturing is very important, and Ohio is the perfect place to see a renaissance and a boost in manufacturing, particularly for the new industries like energy efficiency and like wind turbines and solar power. Our basic manufacturers have the ability to get from here to there, and boosting them in moving into the new industries of the future is critically important. But our report was not about the trickle-down of industrial development. We need to focus on industrial development. Our report was on working with families that are struggling in the low-wage economy. And what we found is that in the last 3.5 years, even as the deepest poverty, people living at half the poverty level and lower, even as that increased in Ohio, and Ohio saw the third greatest jump amongst all the states in deep poverty over the last dozen years, and even a greater increase in the share of children living in deep poverty. This is what we need to address. There is a focus on it this fall, and in the context of that worsening increase in poverty, we need to realize we've slashed our programs that help give people a leg up. Our cash assistance program fell by 71% since January of 2011. our public child care assistance program, which helps parents get and keep jobs, has been reduced in eligibility. It's been narrowed in eligibility, so far less people can access this assistance. This is what we need to focus on this fall. How do we take our large, low-wage population and give them a boost on the career ladder and the energy and the earnings ladder? And this is really from an investment in our safety net programs, not a concentrated effort to reduce public assistance. We need to get people into job training. We need to support them there. And we need to look at a renewed social contract between business and workers in which our private employers are paying a larger share of the cost of their employees' basic costs of living. Right now, that gap between what people earn and what they need to live on is being picked up by the public sector. That needs to be turned around.
Well, let me just say, you know, I think that Wendy's report has some good news in it that says one of the reasons that our public assistance programs have been falling is because people are making more money. You know, we said that the unemployment rate has fallen. So, for example, about over 10% of, according to Wendy's numbers, the people who left the welfare are doing because their income is now too high for those standards. And so I think that's a good element saying that, of course, we're not going to be spending as much as we were during the depths of the recession, because no matter how slow the recovery is, at least we are recovering. I think the other thing I think to remember is that, you know, as bad as poverty is right now, a single mother in poverty, even during the Great Recession, the poverty rates for single women was never as high as it was before Bill Clinton enacted welfare reform. You know, we had the great bipartisan welfare reform in 1996. And a key facet of that was saying you should have benefits, but let's make sure that we put work attached to them and let's create a culture of work. And we saw poverty rates, even in the Great Recession, still lower than they were before Bill Clinton enacted welfare reform. And so I think, you know, being able to attach work requirements like Ohio has and has continued to being focused on is our best way to make sure that a lot of families don't fall in poverty, because as we know, work is the number one antidote. Work in a good family is the number one antidote for anti-poverty measures. And what we need to do is focus on how we put more people back to work and how can we encourage them to work for their benefits.
Stuart, if I could, one difference between the profile of the outcomes of Ohio's programs for the very poorest cash assistance is that only about half of the share of people who leave the program because their income rises. In Ohio, that the share is lower than it is in the national picture. And we actually remove or sanction more than a quarter of our participants from the program because they fail to succeed at work activity. Clearly, families have come into the program because they aren't making it in private work activity. We do need a focus on improving our programs for the people who are at the really very poor. We need to expand that, and we do need to improve our ability to get people leaving that program because of income. It takes investment, and what we're concerned about, we're afraid that the track record in Ohio is such that what we tend to do is reduce public assistance instead of increasing investment in it to allow families to get traction. We have seen Governor Kasich expand Medicaid. He worked hard with the controlling board to get around a legislative body that did not enact expanded Medicaid in the General Assembly. That is very helpful for families at the bottom. It's that kind of investment that we need to help families get ahead.
And the EITC.
We've got a little bit less than 2 minutes left. What should this next General Assembly, the current General Assembly, and the one that follows it need to, what do they need to be doing to try and directly deal with some of these issues, because it just doesn't seem to be going away?
Sure. I think, you know, anytime you come out of recession, you're obviously going to have renewed focus on saying, how can you help people move up the ladder, increase mobility? The Assembly needs to look at policies that, instead of adding more burden on employers, to take a look and say, what are the good policies we can do to help encourage people to work? Things like when Governor Kasich expanded the earned income tax credit, that is a strong anti-poverty measure that helps people that are actually working move up the scale. We need to take a look at simplifying and quite frankly, a lot of the regulations and laws that we have in Ohio that have passed massive amount of taxes that discourage business investment and job growth.
Okay. And we're really creeping up on the hour here, but I want to thank you both for joining us. Wendy Patton, the project director at Policy Matters Ohio, and Ray Perlman. Ray Hederman, I don't know what Perlman came from, is the executive director of the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy. Thank you both for joining us this afternoon. I mean, it's a conversation that could really go on for a long time, and perhaps we'll be doing some follow-ups on this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, and you're listening to 89.7 NPR News.